your client's ability, discussions with together by Greg Paz and Greg
Starr. Okay. Okay, good afternoon. Today we'll be talking about two slightly complementary but not directly related topics. I'll be talking about how shear flows affect gravitational instability as well as how magnetic shear affects gravitational instability. And then about halfway through I'll turn it over to Woong Tae Kim here, and he'll be discussing finite temperature effects in the bulbous Hawley instability. So to start out with, this is work that I've been doing with Steve Cowley at UCLA. Essentially, we are looking at gravitational instability in magnetized shear flows. So as a brief introduction to what I'm doing and motivation for doing this work, the main motivation behind this is try to attempt to gain a basic understanding of how magnetic shear and how shear flow affect gravitational instability. So I'm actually not going to be talking directly about shear flow instabilities, not instabilities that are driven by the shear, but we want to see how shear affects instabilities that are already there, gravitational instabilities or entropy gradient instabilities. So to do this, we conducted a local linear stability analysis of the normal modes of a system that had both magnetic shear and a linear velocity shear. And I'm actually going to spend quite a while, probably about half the time I'm talking, explaining the geometry, because I think magnetic shear is something that's a little bit foreign to most of the people in this audience. And it's a very three-dimensional concept, so you really have to get the geometry straight in your head to understand what I'll be talking about. And what we're going to be looking at is the unstable modes which minimize field line bending. So it will twist the field line a little bit, but it won't bend it an extreme amount. In terms of magnetic shear, this occurs where two sheared field lines cross each other, and you'll see what I'm talking about when I get to that point. Applications of this, in accretion disks physics, we're all familiar with the magnetorotational or bulbous Hawley instability. But as the magnetic field strength increases, or the Alphain speed increases, this instability tends to be stabilized by magnetic tension forces, because that instability tends to bend the field lines quite a lot. So we're interested in examining a slightly different regime where you've got strong field and try to find where instabilities can occur when the field is strong and when the bulbous Hawley instability is stabilized. This has possible application to the base of the solar convection zone, where below the solar convection zone, we've already talked about this in a lunch last week or perhaps the week before, there's a strong toroidal field there, and at some point it becomes unstable due to magnetic buoyancy or other effects and pops up into the base of the convection zone and then is convected to the surface. And this is not a very well understood process, and we think that this research may be able to provide a little insight into how that happens. Also, something that's a sideline to what people are interested in here, but is also very relevant to this research, is the topic of fusion confinement. And a recent idea, which has gained a lot of popularity in the last decade or so, is to use velocity shear to stabilize ballooning modes. They're essentially magnetic interchange modes that occur in a tokamak. They can ruin your confinement very easily. And the thought is that by including velocity shear, you can actually suppress these ballooning modes. I won't talk about that a whole lot today because it's a little bit out of our range of interest. So to start out, let me go ahead and explain a little bit about the field geometry of a sheared magnetic field so you can get a picture of what this looks like in an unperturbed state. What we have is an unperturbed shear magnetic field given by this equation, and I have a diagram of it below. And so the red field lines here, these are the red and the blue lines as well as the black line here, which corresponds to the z-axis, are the field lines. These dotted lines are just to give you sort of a guide to seeing what this looks like. All the field lines that pass through the x-axis at this point are mapped here as you move through different x values. And you can see that it's sheared, so it's kind of like a plane which is, or a surface which is tilted this way. And as you move forward in Z, it tilts as it moves. So if you can see that, this surface is actually going to be very important to what I'm talking about. And in our ordering of the equations, we're actually looking at instabilities which occur and stay within this plane. So when the field line bends, it will stay within this surface. And the pressure is, the pressure and forces are in equilibrium, orthogonal or normal to these surfaces of magnetic shear.
Is this a 4-3-2?
Yes, it is. So this is the unperturbed magnetic field, and then we put one more interesting bit of physics in here, which is the shear flow. Let's grab these. Oh yeah. Okay. So now that picture that we talked about before is still the same. Now I've chosen only two field lines, one above the x equals zero plane and one below the x equals zero plane, the red and the blue lines. And now we introduce this plasma shear flow, which is given by this equation. So as you move up in x, the plasma is flowing either to the left for x values below zero, and for x greater than zero, it's flowing to the right. So what happens is a demonstration of this. If you're looking from above and you're looking at the red and the blue field line, they'll look something like this.
Is it really 4-3? It's only 4-3 is the lowest order in the x. It's grad p plus b squared. As long as the x is small, the second order is.
So what we have is these two field lines, and as one of them moves to the left, the other moves to the right, they move along, and the point where they cross travels in the z direction, and we can actually specify what that velocity is. So that was just a demonstration of what this looks like, and we actually will transform to a frame where the point where these two field lines cross is always at z equals zero, so that we can investigate what happens at that point. So in transforming to that frame, what happens is we now, in that moving frame, have a flow of plasma in the z direction moving at a certain velocity. And I'll talk about the coordinate transformation now. So what we have is...
Sure.
Okay, I'll talk a little bit more about the applications at the end of this. We can look at accretion disks, at solar convection zone.
Okay, but which direction is this supposed to be? Azimuthal shear, or what direction is this shear?
Okay, the shear would be changing as you move. Our x-coordinate here is actually, say, in an accretion disk would be radial. And I have pictures at the end of this that'll show where that goes. So, in fact, if the center of the... Well, I'll just show you where that is. Let me just show you the picture. It's easier than trying to explain it. This is what it would look like in an accretion disk. You take everything. I mean, I've actually tilted that thing now. And so the x direction would be radial, the y direction would be toroidal, and the z direction would be poloidal. So that's how that goes. And I have another picture of what it looks like. So I can show that at the end.
Motivation actually was at the center of the galaxy, which is very strong, and then the galaxy.
Okay.
Vertical field. We wanted to know how clouds and plasma from outside, which has horizontal field, parallel to this, could get through those vertical field lines towards the center. And so one of the ways is by trying to interchange it, we've got field lines that are tilted at the start.
Okay. So just a brief mention of the coordinate transformation that we do. The main part of the transformation is we transform to a frame moving with a constant velocity, Vf, which we'll call the flow velocity, because in the transform frame, that's how fast the plasma is flowing through our frame. Of course, if you transform back to the lab frame, the plasma flow is perpendicular to that. But we transform to that frame, and then we also transform to a what we call magnetic coordinates. This y prime coordinate, if you just take z prime and put it here, and don't worry about the time dependence, now you're at a point where that crossing, where the field lines cross, are always at z equals zero. This this equation actually describes that surface that I showed you, that sheared magnetic surface. So when we do the ordering of these equations, all the motion to this instability is going to be along that surface. And let me show you a picture of what that actually will look like. It's sort of a grossly exaggerated picture, so please don't scream at me that this is a linear theory and this is way beyond a linear perturbation here. This is essentially a picture of what this looks like. Now let me orient you to what view you're taking, what perspective you have on this picture. Here what we have is we have the original field line is going in this direction. Say the red field line is here, and you're looking down Z. You're looking along Z, so the field line here above you is tilted slightly this direction. The field line below you is tilted slightly that direction. So when this instability occurs, as these field lines bend, they actually have to twist to stay along that that sheared magnetic surface. So you can see here that they kind of twist around each other. And this is the characteristic geometry of this instability. And it always occurs at z equals 0. So in the lab frame, this little twist is actually traveling along due to the shear flow. Anyway, so that's what it looks like. Hopefully that gives you a good picture. Yes?
I was going to ask you, where you have the velocity of the frame that you go to, what were the two length scales there?
Okay, the two length scales are, let me just write that down. The two length scales are the shear magnetic, the length scale of a magnetic shear, which is LB, and then the length scale of a velocity shear, which is LV. So essentially this velocity is not a real plasma velocity. It's just one that is moving along at the same speed as that X point.
I swear that it could be extremely large, I guess.
Yes. If the magnetic shear is very small, okay, and so in that case you have a situation where these two lines are almost parallel and you move them slightly, that crossing point moves very fast. So if you have them sheared a lot, which means LB is a smaller number, and you move them at the same speed, that X point moves much more slowly. No. There's no flow velocity actually moving at that speed. The only flow that we actually have in the lab frame is this sheared flow, which is actually in the Y direction. It's not in the Z direction at all. Yeah. And it can be much lower than the flow velocity that we define in our problem.
These coordinates can be thought of as a generalization. People looked at shear flow instabilities as shearing coordinates, which are shear overstress. But now we've got magnetic coordinates that are also twisting in the other direction. So you imagine have something that's sort of twisted in this direction, sheared in that direction. And what you'll see is the bit that's upright moves along in the Z direction. Sort of like a barber pole type of situation.
Yeah. Okay, so so essentially we've got, what we do is we take the system and we start out with ideal MHD, linearize it, and in our ordering of the equations we assume that the pressure balance from one of these magnetic sheared surfaces to the next one in that direction perpendicular, that pressure is in equilibrium. That actually eliminates the fast magnetosonic wave from our system, leaves us with a slow magnetosonic wave and Alphane waves. What we get is a fifth order set of ordinary differential equations in Z. This is very complex, so all I'm going to talk about today is actually an approximation of that, the Boussinesq approximation or the high beta limit. And what happens in that case is the slow magnetosonic wave collapses to the Alphane wave velocity, so you only have one wave in your system. And you get a third order set of equations. What we have here is writing this in Alsasser variables, A plus and A minus. We have the left and right moving Alphane waves, and S, our third variable, is the entropy. And what we have here is essentially a system with an eigenvalue gamma, which is the growth rate of this instability, and two parameters that this depends on. It only depends on two parameters, M and S naught prime. M is the Mach number of this flow velocity that we've defined with respect to the Alphane velocity. S naught prime is the fundamentally is a normalized version of the entropy gradient in our system. So it actually includes the effects of magnetic shear. The strength of magnetic field comes through the Alphane velocity, the strength of gravitational forcing, which is G, and then the pressure and density gradients. So that is essentially the forcing which drives this instability, and we want to see how that changes with M and where marginal stability lies. So,
are we to think that the 1 upon 1 plus z squared to 1 half factors are basically the manifestation of the shear?
Yes. Those are due to the shear. So as this thing moves over, as z increases, that say the vertical component will get very small because it's going to bend over like that. Yeah.
Gamma real.
Okay. We've solved this in two ways. We've solved this both using a one-dimensional shooting code, which you guess a value for gamma and then shoot across, and you can refine your value to get a value of gamma that solves your equations. And we've also done a direct determination of this using a canned routine called LAPACK, which you just discretize the third order set of equations and solve the matrix. And what we actually get is gamma is either real or imaginary, and we get a continuous set of values along the imaginary axis. Any traveling wave through the system is an acceptable eigenvalue, as well as we get unstable values, positive real gamma values, which correspond to instability.
So maybe it looks like it's self-adjoint. It looks
right.
Like the stationary case.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've been unable to prove that.
Yeah, okay. It's not obvious.
Right? Yeah. I can, if you want to see a picture, I can show you a picture of the spectrum of eigenvalues that we got, but I won't do that right now. Okay, so what we get, if we want to look at the stability with respect to these two parameters, the Mach number, I've called it gravity here because you can't do knots and primes in the in SM that I know of. So this is essentially the entropy gradient. I just called it gravity for a more simple audience. Anyway, so what we find here is this, and let me explain a few of the interesting features of this sort of master stability plot. These are, of course, plots of, contours of constant growth rate, and this is the marginal stability line here. So everything down here is stable, and everything up here is unstable. The first interesting thing to note is actually qualitatively the behavior depends on whether you're in a region up here where the growth rate is very healthy and growing very quickly, in which case, as you increase the plasma flow, as you move from a point here along a horizontal line here, you go to a lower and lower growth rate, which means that you're becoming more and more stable. You're suppressing the instability. However, if you're down here near marginal stability, you can start at a point where you're in a stable state, but as you increase the velocity, what happens is it actually can become unstable. So this was a big surprise to us. We expected it to always become more stable. Our explanation, a simple physical picture of why this is occurring, what we think is that you have essentially two modes which are traveling. You've got a right moving and a left moving Alphane wave. The mode that is moving in the direction that this X point is moving will interact with the local region where the instability can occur around z equals zero for a longer time, and so can grow in a larger and larger and can grow more in the time that it's in that region where it can be unstable. Yes.
Can I just ask what you mean by instability? What is the instability mechanism? You're talking about the shear flow and the sort of suppressants.
Well, if you let's take away the Mach number and just look on the right hand side, it's just points.
It's magnetic buoyancy.
No, it's not magnetic buoyancy. It's
there's an entropy gradient.
Density
in this case,
buoyancy.
Beta's not to be
sure.
Yeah.
So it's the short shot.
Yeah.
Right? But without magnetic field, then it would just be S naught prime is greater than zero.
Right.
But because we've got magnetic field.
Yeah, this point here is not at zero.
S naught prime at zero flow velocity, it has a finite amount of S naught prime to bend the field lines. But now you add the shear flow, and it's how it varies.
Yeah. Does that answer your question? Yeah, it's a magnetic tension that stabilizes the system.
Yeah,
so
if you look at
zero Mach number, you have to go up to a certain amount.
Yeah.
Gravity is really S mod prime, right? In Schwarzschild criteria, you have to go up to a certain finite amount of that to bend.
So K is in what direction?
K is predominantly perpendicular to the field. It's trying to interchange, but it can't. You can't interchange two field lines like this, because here you have to move them an infinite distance. So you have to bend the field in the process of trying to interchange them.
So this is for the mode of maximum growth rate,
This is the maximum growth rate.
Depends on the shift.
So again, with some magnetic field there, what is the use for the equivalent? What is the gamma equals zero there?
It corresponds to essentially whether you have a positive or negative entropy gradient. So if you're at zero, it would always be at zero.
How is it signed then?
Pardon me?
Sign points to zero.
Gravity points downwards.
But I mean, the parameters that you had to characterize the stratification.
Yes, that's prime sign.
Yeah, yeah. It can be positive or negative. And a negative value would be stable. In any case, whether there's a magnetic field or not, you just have a stable stratification. If you have a positive value and you have a magnetic field which is strong enough, you can still stabilize it. So it can be unstable, but the magnetic field can keep it from going unstable. Yeah.
This question was almost stable when you have just convection plus magnetic field.
I'm sorry, I really don't
have. When you have just magnetic field.
Well, you don't have any shear in the magnetic field. Newcomb showed many, many years ago that the interchange is just as fast. The same criterion as the Schwarzschild one. You just interchange the field.
Yes.
Right? But because we have a shear in our magnetic field, you can't interchange.
But we're talking about the points where you have Mach number zero, you have no shear there.
You have no velocity shift, and there's magnetic shift.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There's magnetic shift.
Right. Yeah.
Magnetic
right.
shift stops you just interchanging the two field lines.
Right. Okay.
Yes,
go ahead, Steve.
Just ask again about the wave number of the mode of maximum growth rate. That stays constant as you increase the maximum growth rate.
The wave number. Go ahead.
The wave number is predominantly perpendicular to the field lines, because they're interchanged, right? The most unstable interchange mode has peaked up close to infinity. And that's true as you go all the way up to 1 in this case.
At B equals 0, where is the Richardson criterion in this plot?
I'm not familiar with the Richardson criterion. What is that?
Basically, V prime squared versus buoyancy frequency.
Okay, one thing is that this is the incompressible case, so there's no...
That's incompressible.
Okay, yeah.
He's looking at combined velocity, magnetic shear, and buoyancy. But if you turn off the magnetic field, you should encounter the Richardson's number somewhere.
Well, I'm not certain, but I think he's picked his shear such that it cannot ever satisfy.
No, but he might be over there, because he doesn't have magnetic buoyancy either, because he should be on his left hand off.
I'm not talking about magnetic.
I know, I'm just saying there are other instabilities.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't have it because he's in the convective lead. In Richardson's criterion, has what?
Yeah, this is already unstable.
So what happens if you make it buoyancy unstable and crank up the shear flow? That limit of Richardson.
Well, it's a little bit different because we have magnetic shear in this case, which drastically changes it. But you could do that with this, but we haven't looked at that limit of things with our system.
Certainly test S naught prime below zero.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always stable if S naught prime is negative. Okay. So those are two of the qualitatively different behaviors. The other thing to note is that as all these lines go towards M equals 1, which is essentially the Mach 1 transition, okay, all of these shoot up to infinity. So it means that no matter where you are in this, as you move towards m equals 1, it becomes stable. Of course, our solution breaks down at m equals 1. And then there are no, above m equals 1, if you're in the supra-alphenic regime, there are no stable growing eigenmodes of the system. It may be possible, and I'll talk about this as far as future work, to have algebraic growth, to have non-normal solutions. But in terms of In terms of normal eigenmodes, there are none above m equals 1. So it is stable above here. Okay. So to talk a little bit about applications, I won't go into too much detail, but just to show where you can put this in into the kinds of problems that we're interested in, I've just essentially taken that exact that same figure and put it into the geometry of something. I showed you this briefly earlier. For accretion disks, X would be the radial direction, Y would be the toroidal direction, and Z would be the poloidal direction. And so this would correspond to a magnetic field which is slightly sheared as you move outward in radius and is mainly in the vertical direction. And so this could be important for cases where you have very strong magnetic field and you want to see if these things are actually unstable, if there's a positive, if there's an unstable entropy gradient, what is the condition for sheared magnetic field to support that or to become unstable? Another application, I'll talk very briefly about this, is fusion confinement. They thought a lot recently that you can use shear flow to suppress MHD ballooning instabilities. And our results show that actually near marginal stability, shear flow actually enhances the instability. However, as the M equals 1 transition is approached, as I mentioned before, the plasma becomes stable. And so if you're above M equals 1, and remember that this doesn't necessarily mean that your plasma flow is supersonic or superalphenic. It just means that the that this characteristic velocity, which depends both on the magnetic shear and the velocity shear, that just has to be above the Alphane number. And the final application that I want to talk about very briefly, that you can look at this, is if you want to look at the base of the solar convection zone, now essentially you still have X is your radial direction, Y is your toroidal direction, and Z is your poloidal direction. So up at any point here, of course, this is anybody will know. I mean, these are going mostly in the poloidal direction, which we know that the main component of the magnetic field is toroidal below the solar convection zone. But it may give us some clues as to what happens when you have a slightly sheared field and you can have a positive entropy gradient. And as well, in our fifth order case, and this is something I didn't mention, I didn't want to go into the details, but in our fifth order, which is a compressible case for this, which allows anything to happen, you also have the Parker instability drive, so you can get magnetic buoyancy instabilities as well. So if you're interested in that kind of an instability, we can model that with this system. So the thought is this may give us a little bit of insight into terms of how this magnetic field can become buoyantly unstable and pop up into the base of the convection zone. So that is about the end. Just to talk a little bit about where we'd like to go with this in the future, I need to finish looking at the general fifth order compressible case and see what happens in this case. So in that case, you actually have four parameters. There are two driving forces, and then as well, there's your Mach number as well as your plasma beta, which can be varied. So we want to know what is the stability criteria in as you vary those parameters. We'd also like to investigate the non-normal mode growth using an initial value code. And of course, then write this up for publication. And then one last thing I just want to briefly mention that we're interested in looking at is as you move in the parallel direction, okay, and I didn't talk about the parallel modes here because we were talking about an incompressible case, so there's always equilibrium along the field lines. But in the compressible case, you can actually have perturbations which are in the direction along the field lines. So we're interested in actually looking for 1D nonlinear shock formation, okay, as you approach the Mach number equals 1. So as you move along, our thought is that the perturbation in the velocity will be moving, say, at the speed that is the slow magnetosonic wave speed. It'll be moving along. And as that crossing point approaches that speed in the reference frame that we're looking at, the transform frame that's moving along with this plasma flow, that slow magnetosonic wave will be moving slower and slower. So the perturbation along the field line will be moving slower than slower and slower. And so we're interested in looking at the case when you're moving along, and as you can see, the field line bends down as you approach that X point. So the thought is that if this perturbed velocity is nearly at the Alphane speed, as it falls into this this little sort of well here, it can gain a little bit of energy and actually reach the Mach number 1, and then you can get a shock formation there. So that's a possibility that we'd like to look into. And then I just want to go ahead and commence research on my PhD thesis. So that's it. If anybody has any questions, I'll answer them and then turn things over to Wung Tai to talk about the role of solid instability. Yes,
example. The cause of the instability is the contraction instability.
Yes. Yes, it's unstable, and it's stabilized essentially by the sheared magnetic field.
Exactly.
Right.
And then you look for the action of the...
Yeah, and then on top of the shear, I mean, it's a very simple stability criterion for the shear.
The base of the convection is a little bit better, and could be grabbed in this headline, not instability.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but the fifth
fair
order
enough.
Set then has...
Yeah, there's also a Parker drive, also.
The fifth order set has the Parker drive, essentially.
Yeah, magnetic buoyancy drive. So, S-naught prime, the...
It's so much more complicated, you want to present just the...
Yeah, if anybody has any comments about this or wants to talk about the more complicated case that has magnetic buoyancy, essentially the Parker instability, I'd be more than happy to talk to them about it, but I don't want to do it now because, Wung Tai needs time to talk. So, okay, no other questions. I'll turn it over to Wung Tai. Kim, thank you.
I'm going to talking about the temperature dependence of MRIs, and this is a part of the work I have done last year with my advisor, Dr. Ivo Stryker. And basically, I think everybody knows well about the MRIs here, but I want to talk, the basic motivation for this work is that incompressibility is mostly assumed in the study of the MRI because the temperature in the accretion disk is very high, so compressibility is not important. But there are many systems such as MHD disk wind in which temperature is very low, so maybe we think that compressibility can affect the MRIs to modify the outcome. So this is a basic motivation of this work. But there are two different MRIs. One is axisymmetric toroidal field MRI, and the other is non-axisymmetric toroidal field MRI. both of them becomes unstable when this condition is met. The angular velocity is decreasing function of radius. But even though they share the same instability criterion, this one, but we found that this the underlying physical mechanism for these two instabilities are quite different. I will explain about this. So initial configuration is relatively simple. So I assume the ideal MHD condition and uniform density, temperature, and magnetic field. Magnetic field has two components, azimuthal and vertical component. And inclination angle of the magnetic field is defined as the angle between the magnetic field and horizontal plane. And there is the shear rotation speed is a function of a radius like this. And gradient of omega is negative all the way. So this is a schematic diagram to explain how axisymmetric toroidal MRI develops. axisymmetric polar field MRI is normally called BH bulbous and Hawley instability, following from the bulbous and Hawley paper in 1991, and in which they explain the physical mechanism about this. And first, I think the vertical field initially, as described by red line here, and a perturbed this material move faster along this azimuthal direction, and this material slower to the background fluid. And this two perturbing motion disturb the magnetic field to bend the field line like this. And there is a toroidal perturbed field. And when magnetic field is line, magnetic field line bent like this, there is a tension exerted along this direction, here and here. And torque, due to the shear exerting on this blob, remove the angular momentum from this blob. And this blob tended to move inside radially inward. And this blob, the torque exerting on this blob add angular momentum to this one, and this one moves outward radially. So this one is moving in, and this one is moving out. So this motion, because by assumption, the rotation, angular velocity of rotation is negative, gradient of omega is negative. So as this blob moves in, this one tended to rotate faster, and this one, as this blob moves out, this one tended to move slower. And this is exactly the same situation of like this. So this is a runaway process. If we perturb this one, and this one becomes this one, and this one after some time becomes this one. So this is a runaway process. So what happens if we include the toroidal field here? So because if there is initially toroidal component of the field, the combined effect of the perturbed field generates the vertical pressure gradient of magnetic field. So the vertical pressure gradient tends to distribute this perturbed toroidal field as uniformly as possible along the vertical direction. So inclusion of toroidal field suppresses the axisymmetric MRI. This is a dispersion diagram of the axisymmetric MRI. The X scale is the normalized vertical wave number, and Y is normalized frequency. When magnetic field is mainly vertical, there is no temperature dependence on the axisymmetric MRI. But as the toroidal component becomes stronger, the temperature effect, temperature makes bulbous Hawley instability stable. For example, if the inclination angle is less than 30 degrees, for the Keplerian rotation, there is no bulbous Hawley instability if the temperature is very low. In this case, for example, this diagram shows that when I equals 20 degrees, if beta is zero, there is no bulbous Hawley instability here. Now, I want to explain the physical mechanism of non-axisymmetric toroidal field MRI. So in this case, we need a non-zero value of azimuthal wave number M. And I assume that here, K is very large, greater than the M. So suppose that we have the initial perturbation like this. Initial perturbation is just damaged wave motion, because there is non-zero value of M and non-zero value of Kg. The wave is just the sinusoidal along azimuthal direction and vertical direction. So here we have vertical, this is vertical axis, and this is azimuthal axis. So here we have converging motion and diverging motion of vertical velocity. So because of the if I assume the incompressibility here, because of the continuity equation, the material here has to move along this way or along this way, because to satisfy the continuity equation. So we have here azimuthal velocity field like this. If this system is rotating, there is a centrifugal and Coriolis force. So now this motion feels some this directional Coriolis force, and this motion feels this directional Coriolis force. So this is radial direction, and this is azimuthal direction. So there is a induced perturbed radial velocity here. Because this is initial field direction, so this perturbing motion bends the field line like this to generate perturbed radial field. So at this point, radial field line is negative and positive here, like this. And then we have a shear velocity. The inside rotates faster, outside rotates slower. So this perturbed radial field line slowly, progressively becomes azimuthal, like this. So at this point, we have a negative perturbed azimuthal field and positive perturbed azimuthal field. So at this point, combined field is very small, weaker. The field strength at this point becomes weaker because this is negative. And field strength at this point becomes higher because these are positive. So this is initial perturbation, but after some time, there is no restoring force because at this point, field becomes weaker as they compress. If they are compressed, becomes weaker. As they are rarefied, they are becomes stronger. So this is a runaway process. This is dispersion relation to show the how non-axisymmetric MRI operate. This is normalized azimuthal wave number and growth rate. And in this case, contrary to the axisymmetric polar field MRI, in this case, we can get the most unstable growth rate when vertical wave number is infinity. And there is no toroidal field MRI if temperature is very low. So we found that in a system where temperature is very low, the axisymmetric and non-axisymmetric MRI is not operating efficiently. So my conclusion is, as I explained before, even though they share the similar instability criterion, the operating mechanism for axisymmetry and non-axisymmetry MRI is quite different. And in a cold medium, axisymmetry MRI is stabilized by compressibility completely if the inclination angle is very small. And MH disk wind, which have very low temperature and inclination angle is very small, this system is not subject to the MRIs. That's my conclusion. Thank you. Any questions?
Do you want to say something about the method since we're discussing shear flow? That is the method.
The analysis of the instability in a non-axisymmetric instability in a shearing fluid is not trivial because when we analyze the instability KR, radial wave number is function of time. So there is no eigen mode when we try to fully analyze the system. But if we assume that the fluid variable, for example, chi, is a function of time, it's very like this. So if we assume that this functional behavior of a physical variable and gamma is a function of time because of this behavior, we know that this gamma is not an eigenvalue because every different variable has a different value of gamma. For example, the continuity here, the if we analyze it using this one, then we have KR. Here, some additional term here. So because this is a function of time, so this is not an eigenfunction, eigenvalue. But if we assume this is so-called temporal WKV condition of the eigenvalue, then we can apply the same Fourier mode analysis to this system to find the growth rate. So this is the method we adapted to find these eigenfunctions and eigenmode, eigenvalue for the non-axisymmetric case.
What is new in your formula?
Gamma. Gamma. Sorry, this is gamma. Gamma is growth rate.
On the right hand side is also gamma.
This one? Right. This is also gamma.
So the point is that, I mean, normally when you have a shear flow, you have to either integrate an initial value. In general, you have to integrate some initial value problem or look for normal mode. But if it's rapidly growing in some sense, or more generally, if you're comparing this mess, then you can look for as you said, it's WKV in time, so there's an instantaneous growth rate. Mm-hmm. And as we know, there's some temporary growth and then exaggeration. That's always the case for these shear flow non-stabilities.
Isn't the issue in some of these things one of, does the perturbation grow to nonlinear size in a time scale that's short to any compared to any sort of rollover in the transient growth? Right.
Right. I mean that's the point.
So it seems to be that's the class of things you want to determine, right?
Right. So that criterion is generally met for the magneto rotational. And you can also show that for it's meant for buoyancy modes when m is large enough. So I guess this is related to the ballooning stabilization of shear of ballooning modes by shear. So we also looked at the related problem in the context of disk winds that the buoyancy modes are stabilized by shear, so they grow to some limited amplitude and then they saturate.
Right.
Can I ask for clarification? Steve Atlas and I actually looked at the isosymmetric case with compressibility some time ago. I'm just trying to remember what we found, which is sort of embarrassing. But when you say that, compressibility stabilizes the axisymmetric modes for very cold disks. Are you still restricting consideration to subthermal magnetic field strengths? Or not?
No,
supersoma.
So for subthermal fields, compressibility, it's still true that compressibility doesn't affect the isosymmetric mode.
Yes.
Okay.
Your analysis, of course, is local, so you don't really see the kink instability, but for the parameters that you discussed in the last item, wouldn't the wind already be kink unstable?
I think the kink instability is global instability.
Yes.
Global. But this is local analysis.
Yes, yes, yes.
But we can't find it because we just analyzed the local analysis.
I mean, in fact, kink may be stabilized if you have some axial fields in the form, which is something that is likely to be the case.
Right. Now, you didn't discuss the axial field, of course. So suppose you had an axial field that would actually stabilize kink instability. Mm-hmm. What would then happen to the MRI in that case?
Well, they're not in the same place. I mean, people argue that there's an axial field in the center and then toroidal field mm-hmm. on the outside.
So it's like the disk of the galaxy, where it's axial and middle and largely in the plane.
And what is that reason, please?
It accumulates towards in the galaxy, it accumulates towards the center. You can't get rid of the vertical component. Like what is it by voice? Yes, the result of accretion in the center. The vertical component can't be rid of by voice. So if the field gets stronger, it gets more and more buoyant, so it tilts itself upwards.
Some had speculated that there was an alpha squared dynamo operating in the center of the field. I don't know whether that's still being pursued.
Well, since all the field looks better, so it's hard to imagine the dynamo is going on.
What?
Since all the field looks vertical, it's hard to imagine a dynamo is going on, since there seems to be no perturbation.
Even with the clouds bang up against the vertical filaments, one way to estimate the field strength is by the fact that they don't bend the vertical filaments. So that seems to suggest that at least at this time, there's no operating time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Suppose the vertical field in the center could have come from going up. It could be a central object spewed out that vertical field.
Mm-hmm.
So
based on whether the field is intermittent there, I guess it's sort of, we don't know whether.
Well, if it were in tubes, those tubes are hard to imagine that they're in equilibrium with a Gauss field unless they have the little pinches in themselves, right? They would have to have current flowing up them so that they can pinch themselves, because otherwise they would simply expand into the gap between them.
Is there any evidence for flows along the tubes?
In the central galaxy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What sort of speeds?
There isn't any observational evidence. It's just the fact that the pressure gradient is going outwards. And so, I guess,
the thermal speed there is enormous, about 10 to 8 degree Kelvin plasma, and so if it expands out up to that speed, it would be going extremely fast, hundreds of kilometers a second.
And what is the alpha intensity?
It's a little bit higher. It's about 10 times.
It's 1 to 3 times.
Yeah. But do we know the density?
Yeah, they do. It's about 0.3, 0.1 particles per cubic centimeter. The beta is very small, about 1% in depth. Yeah.
There is some evidence for a wind in the center, at least from X-ray data, which shows the kind of cigar-shaped stuff, which if you assume this kind of sound state, it's about 80 parsecs long, so it's like that. But it's probably bigger than the flying.
But in terms of direct measurement, I don't think there's any measurements to measure dot to
shift
or
something.
But it's just not bound at that temperature.
want to continue?
Relevance of the MRI to the accretion disks, which is the original motivation for all the work that presented so far. I just want to, I have really just three view graphs here that I want to flash. The first aspect is related to the magnetic field, whether or not we can or should assume that the magnetic field is imposed or whether it is actually generated by a dynamo. As far as the local simulation is concerned, both cases are possible and have been investigated. It is possible to impose a magnetic field in the vertical direction or in the horizontal direction and calculate the instability analytically or numerically. This work goes back to the beginning of this decade, last decade. Whereas also, it is also possible that the magnetic field itself can actually be regenerated by dynamo action, as sketched here in this plot. So the Balbo-Solli or magneto-rotational instability generates velocities from the magnetic field that can go turbulent if the diffusivities and resistivities are small enough. But given the presence of rotation and very strong shear, the turbulent magnetic turbulent velocity field can actually also act as a dynamo, and it does not suppress the magnetic field, but actually appears to strongly enhance the magnetic field. The second question is, what are kind of boundary conditions can one assume and should one assume? A lot of work has been spent using periodic boundary conditions, but if you actually assume open boundary conditions, they can allow for the fact that flux can be lost, and maybe a more important aspect is that magnetic helicity can be lost, as George Field and Eric Blackman have been pointing out recently. So the assumption of open boundary conditions may be quite crucial to understanding the regeneration mechanism in box calculations such as those. There's a question about the initial condition. Often one is asked, what is the initial magnetic field in your configuration? And one is tempted to say that was some random magnetic field and details don't really matter. To some extent, we have looked into that, and this may be a case for even more systematic investigations. As a preliminary estimate, I would say that it may take up to 30 orbits up until the initial magnetic field is more or less forgotten. Up until that time, the power spectra of the magnetic field do still show signs of the initial condition, and after approximately 30 orbits, the power spectra settle into something more or less generic and independent of the initial condition. That is, of course, typical of turbulence in general, that it is independent of initial conditions. Now, a question that is of really direct astrophysical interest, and that is the question of the Shakura-Sinayev accretion disk parameter. That is a non-dimensional parameter that characterizes the importance of accretion and the stress that is exerted on the gas. And the stress is dominated by the magnetic stress. There's, of course, the Reynolds stress, which is, however, weaker. And alpha is essentially the ratio of the horizontal stress, magnetic stress, relative to the pressure.
I mean, actually, if in fact what you seem to be saying, that the magnetic energy of the fluctuations in this type of system is larger than the hydrodynamic energy.
Yes.
If that's the case, then going back to a few bullets up, isn't the small-scale magnetic field much more of a player in the dynamo than the small-scale velocity field?
Yeah, definitely, yes. It is, in that sense, a dynamo is a scenario regime that is very different from anything that has been studied until now. Yes. Of course, in principle, those ideas of having a dynamo effect that is governed not by velocity fluctuations but by magnetic fluctuations has been elaborated to some extent, and in the ordinance, of course, of George Field and Eric Blackman, who have systematically taken that into account, and I think that will be also part of the discussion tomorrow.
tomorrow? No, next week.
The imbalance of the two.
Yeah. So as a rough estimate, in disks that we have encountered so far, the magnetic energy is typically between 3 and 7 times larger than the turbulent small-scale velocity. By the way, if you look at the geodynamo, then we are actually in a regime which is very, very different again, because in the geodynamo, the magnetic field is anticipated to be something like 3 orders of magnitude larger than the kinetic energy, which is, of course, rather extraordinary and hasn't really caught any attention or any puzzles yet, I guess. Now, about...
Wait a second, if we're just a moment. Isn't it in balance with the Coriolis force, which is another way of saying it is in balance with the total rotational energy rather than the small-scale velocity?
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
But, of course, the large-scale velocity field has nothing to do with an alpha effect if it's there.
No.
So that, in that sense, there's a real puzzle which hasn't been addressed. So the question that is of importance for accretion disks is the magnitude of the stress, the normalized magnitude of the stress. And it is remarkable that the simulation, that both calculations with an imposed field and with a dynamo generated magnetic field actually give very, very comparable values, absolute values of this alpha SS parameter as a function of the mean magnetic field. That is remarkable. So it is. It means if you impose a magnetic field, you can get a certain stress. On the other hand, if you don't impose a magnetic field, you will get a magnetic field from the dynamo. This magnetic field, if you have open boundary conditions, can have a large-scale field. And then you can measure alpha again. And again, it turns out to correlate very much with the mean magnetic field. And I'll show you here a plot which demonstrates that. So in this case here, you see as a dotted line the magnetic energy squared of the mean field, which varies approximately cyclically. And overplotted is the alpha SS, which in this case, by the way, is not measured in terms of the stress, but is actually measured in terms of the heat that is released into the disk. So here the disk actually heats by a factor of 10. Often people think viscosity is or diffusivity.
Are you that you're running simulations where you actually go all the way down to the viscous and resistive length scale, and you actually... You got
to do that, otherwise you would not get this right, of course.
Well,
and so even though the resolution is
such a simulation done in this country, so I'm very interested in that.
But even you mean simulations done in this country, but they I mean you're also satisfying.
Including you, Axel, of course.
You're also satisfying, of course, the energy equation, right?
They are not thermodynamically.
Yeah, then you will not get that right, of course.
Right. So I'm very interested in hearing that you are doing this correctly.
Of course. So it is of course, if anything, really a measurement of the accuracy of the code. So in other words, you have a loss of magnetic energy. You tap energy from the shear, and of course this energy has to go somewhere, and it has to go into the heat eventually. And you're lucky if the code gets that right. And the values of alpha that we've calculated here are within 20% comparable to the alphas.
Can I ask you, given that you've made this major breakthrough, that the alpha that you're calculating from heating doesn't agree with it, with an alpha, that is, that alpha viscosity is a correct parameterization both of angular momentum transport and of energy dissipation.
And even of the mass...
Occurs in my prescription.
Correct, yes. And even of the mass accretion. There are 3 criteria. There's the stress... There's the energy temperature enhancement, and there is the rate of mass accretion, which, of course, you don't have in the standard accretion local box calculation, but you can actually relax this criterion by restoring 1/r terms. And then you get actually a mean flux of matter. And from that, you can also calculate alpha, and that agrees within 20%. Fine, let's carry on. Now, this alpha, however, does vary with height, simply because the magnetic scale height, the magnetic variation with height, is much, much less than the variation with height of the pressure. Of course, the pressure drops rapidly as you leave the disk upwards, but the magnetic field has a larger scale height. And that means that the Shakur-Nesnyayev of alpha, which is essentially the ratio of the two, increases rapidly with height at first, and even within all our local simulations. So anybody who has actually used the alpha Shakur-Nesnyayev if to do anything more than just calculating vertically averaged models, when this is not an issue, should really reconsider this issue of the very strong dependence of alpha as S, the height. There's another important issue that is related to viscosity and resistivity.
Yeah, that's limited, though, because when you get to low density, it's not stable. So.
Yeah, certainly. Eventually, this must again tip down, tilt over, and decrease, which hasn't been seen in any of the local simulations to date. But it must, of course, I mean, we all expect this to happen, of course, in a global simulation. And global simulations are, of course, the ultimate goal of all the work related to this here. So then we would eventually expect that the magnetic field, of course, decays eventually with height, but it doesn't do that within the local calculation yet. Yes. Yes, right. Yes, yes. But in that case, again, alpha must first of all increase and then eventually decrease. Those calculations haven't been carried out for long enough yet to see whether it's a global magnetic field. But I think basically they do agree with this hypothesis. Quadratic. Oh, I didn't show you that. It's quadratic. The alpha is proportional to the magnetic field squared.
Oh.
Although even if, other power laws fit this relatively well.
Axel, related to this point about how alpha varies with height, there's some global situations by Matsumoto and some Japanese collaborators.
But this is an imposed magnetic field.
Yes, and then you find this avalanche layer.
Yeah.
Which, what do you think of that? Is that another simulation? It's at the interface between the disk and the coronal region where the tension, the drag from the coronal region on the disk is greatest. And as the surface of the disk sort of falls inward, it's like a nonlinear ball's falling instability, the drag gets ever greater. And so what they find in their simulations is that the surface of the disk plunges inward,
yeah,
the mid-plane gets pushed outward in their simulations.
First of all, isn't this actually the claim related, first of all, to a two-dimensional calculation?
Yes.
Okay.
The
yes, exactly. And so they are very artificial in that sense, because you get these very strong channel flows.
Should they also have the corona
form rather than those that have the they have it in there, but it's like this initial condition, which is not...
Right. Another important question is related to the importance of viscosity and resistivity, because analytic treatment normally ignores, of course, those two effects. It is, however, of a very important practical and numerical significance, because the presence of viscosity and resistivity, it gives you a lower limit for the wavelength. The wavelength has to be larger than a quantity that is related to the viscosity or diffusivity, magnetic diffusivity, which in astrophysical settings would, of course, really be very small, because that's the molecular microscopic viscosity. It would be very small, but, of course, in all numerical simulations, it's not. And so this gives you a length scale, which, of course, is comparable to the to a few times the mesh size. So in other words, you have to ensure that the wavelength of the instability is at least resolved by a few mesh lengths, and that gives you an upper limit for the Alvin speed, if you turn that into the other way around. So that means if you are actually interested in the dynamo effect, there's no hope to do that starting with very weak seed magnetic fields. You've got to do this with a relatively strong initial field already, and then this can be amplified by yet maybe one more order of magnitude. So that is the dynamical range restriction here. Very important.
Does anything interesting happen when you couple the MRI and the Parker instability? In principle, you should.
First of all, I think the MRI, the Parker instability has a smaller growth rate and also it requires very large wavelengths in the toroidal direction. So in the largest boxes that I've done, the Parker instability is expected to occur because I've done boxes with 24 vertical scale heights of toroidal extent. And we didn't see any change in the characteristics of the overall behavior.
Well, the question is the Parker instability due to a natural dynamo saturation mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. Into the halo.
Yeah.
So the question is then, and I'm just curious, what kind of field strength do you get, and is it at all consistent with observations, et cetera, et cetera?
I think the question of, first of all, Parker instability, of course, can lead to a saturation mechanism, but also the Barbos-Holly instability can lead to a saturation mechanism because you eventually reach field strengths that are close to the saturation limit above which the MRI is no longer unstable. So both are in principle can in principle operate as a saturation mechanism. And I'm not
one
exactly.
One has very different implications for the corona than the other. So I mean, someone mentioned there were simulations done with the corona. I was curious.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have a satisfactory answer to this. It would require a good recipe to characterize the relative importance of these two mechanisms. We have looked at the two contributions from J cross B and found. Stretching and magnetic pressure are both comparable, which, if they are related to the two, could mean that both are equally important. But that's just one way.
It seems to me naive that if there, for example, this observable, then you just appeal to the Parker instability. Just thinking about the saturation value of the field would be larger than that, which comes from the Barbos-Holly, in the sense that you would think it would happen if water is
right. So if that is applicable, it would really mean the Parker instability would be relevant, essentially. Just a few comments towards global models. There are various. Power spectra for the turbulence.
Yes, in terms of the isotropy.
Yeah, they are both. The strongest power is in the both the x and z directions, and the lowest power is in the y direction, as you would expect, even down to the smallest scales.
Which direction is gravity?
I thought the field was in the two things. I mean, I thought the field was largely toroidal.
It is largely toroidal, yes, and also the variation of any quantity in the toroidal direction is smallest.
Oh, okay.
So that's
a large K in the
BY, of course, is largest.
Right.
And the power spectra, the power spectra are more or less compatible with power loss behavior slopes that are actually more or less minus 5/3. Not, they sometimes appear to be steeper, but that is a resolution effect.
So the power is stronger in the K curve direction,
Right. Yeah. Good.
But related to the question of viscosity and resistivity, would you expect to find the same kind of behavior that people have been talking about if the viscosity is much larger than the resistivity?
Possibly not. I mean, the question is, what are you after? If you are after the question of what is the mechanism that deposits energy into the medium. Is it joule heating or is it viscous heating? I have some related work, which is independent of accretion disks, suggesting, in the case of decaying MHC turbulence, that those two rates are actually independent of the magnetic Prandtl number, which is, of course, quite remarkable. So I've done a range of magnetic Prandtl numbers between 1/10 and 200, so covering 2 times 10 to the 3 order of magnitude. Find is essentially independent within 20%. Very, very pretty accurate. So, and then the result for that is one result that we have obtained in this case was that in this case, Joule heating is approximately comparable to the viscous heating, even though most of the energy is actually tapped, first of all, from the magnetic field, by the magnetic field. So first, most of the magnetic energy goes into, most of the energy is tapped by the magnetic energy reservoir. So this is the energy reservoir from the capillary and shear. Some energy is tapped also through the kinetic energy reservoir, but then there's a strong transfer of energy from magnetic energy into kinetic energy, such that the two output exits are approximately comparable. And of course, the sum of those two is equal to the sum of those two. So that's what is going into a thermal heat.
What's the approximate ratio of the magnetic and hydrodynamic stresses?
The what? The ratio?
The ratio of the magnetic and
Also approximately one to between 1 to 3 and 1 to 7.
What are the fluctuations of the magnetic field? Are they larger than the velocity fluctuations? Delta beams.
The delta. First of all the quantities I'm referring to are actually deltas. So therefore, the delta Bs are larger than the delta Us. So delta Bs are larger than delta Us.
By how much?
3 to 7. Because when I'm talking about kinetic energy, I'm talking about the fluctuations only. So I'm subtracting out the shear. So that, therefore, the quantities I'm referring to is delta U.
So at any point in the disk, when you think of resolving fluctuations into some incessant waves or something.
Yeah.
Maybe not really possible because it could be compressible.
It is first of all compressible, yes. It's even stratified, of course.
Then it's asymmetric.
Yeah, I guess so.
Keep monitoring it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have one direction is more...
But also, of course, U and B are not really aligned. I have alignment plots not with me here, but the two are hardly aligned. So it's not really like an Alvin... Statistically. So if anything is aligned, it's actually B is aligned with omega. So that would say... that there's an analogy between magnetic field and vorticity, if anything. But it does not mean that the magnitudes are do correlate. So if the B field is large, both U and omega are small. But nevertheless, the direction of omega is then aligned with B.
Do you have any feel for where this factor 3 to 7 comes from? In particular, is it masking a scaling? Because it's really
it's really quite
remarkable because most MHD turbulent systems like to go to approximate balance, right? And yet, mm-hmm. of course, imbalance is crucial to momentum transport here, right?
Yes, yes.
If you have balance, you'd get zero.
Yeah, yeah, right, yes. I don't know yet. It is a question that can be answered once we have systematic resolution studies. So the question, of course, is, I mean, it is, when I say between 7 and 3, it is in those cases where the dynamo wasn't very strong yet, it's more like 1 to 7. And once the dynamo gets stronger, it tends to decrease this ratio to 1 to 3. And so maybe in more realistic settings, it would actually go very close to 1. Who knows? Yeah, so therefore it has to be somewhat larger. And I'm not sure whether 3 or where actually there is this limit.
Well, the net momentum transport is just the difference of the fluid and magnetic Reynolds stresses, right?
The two have the same sign.
It comes with a sign in between. So if you have a pure, ideal MHD Alphane wave, you're stuck with zero.
Depending on where you are, because BRD5 is first of all.
Equal energy.
So first of all, the negative Maxwell stress, which is just relevant, is positive, and the Reynolds stress is also positive.
Yeah,
so the sum of the two is also positive, of course. There's no cancellation.
No, but the total transport is VRV.
Total transport is the sum of those two. which in the simulation that we have.
There's a sign flip between the two.
Yeah. The fact that this sign is positive, of course, is non-trivial. Because, for example, if you do a calculation with convection, for example, you quite often find that this has actually the wrong sign.
In general, it's quite clear there's a sign difference between the two. So if you had, you know, equal energies and without the sign flip that you claim is non-trivial, then you would get zero.
Yeah.
Could I ask about the fact that the magnetic energy is much greater than the kinetic energy? I'm trying to imagine a situation where the magnetic energy is stored in the forceful field. Why wouldn't it then push the stuff around and get positive equal position? Therefore, I speculate it's force-free, and therefore the J aligns with B. Is that true or false?
It is true in some locations.
I think it's the velocity shear, which, because that's what carries, which is potentially what increases BRV5, the background velocity shear. So, you know, you're sort of getting this little piece of that, but you're not counting in the fluctuations in some sense, the kinetic fluctuations, that the magnetic perturbations are feeding off that background.
That's how you get the imbalance.
A related question to that, I guess, is it's to some extent always true that there is a false free field component, but it's only one part of the flow. And the way to check that is by looking at the histogram of the angles between J and B. Okay, the cases that we have published. You typically find distributions that look more like this, yeah? So most of the points in space have a right angle of J cross B, of J and B, so that means they're not force-free. There's a dramatic change, however, once you include amipolar diffusion. Then the histogram changes to something like this. So once you add amipolar diffusion tends to make the field force-free, and you do in fact see that.
This is even with the fact that there's the pressure, which is still larger than
the yes.
And the shear also.
Yeah. Most of the fluctuation. I didn't quite understand this, but maybe we can discuss it later.
Yeah, okay.
A few more comments here. We really ought to go to global simulations, and there have been a few simplifying assumptions made so far, which in all cases are quite remarkable and interesting, because doing the really global simulation is at the moment rather difficult, especially because you have significant drops of density as you go from the disk into the corona. One approach was the so-called cylindrical disk, which has been introduced by Armitage 2 years ago, where one ignores the vertical extent of the disk altogether. So in other words, the gravitational potential is just a function of radius and not a function of height. So that's a rather unphysical assumption, but it's extremely successful because it allows you for the first time to address the question of a global simulation with respect to the radial direction. Secondly, But for example, there's still more work to be done in this direction. For example, those guys haven't gotten a large-scale magnetic field yet. The question is, can you actually get a large-scale magnetic field in such a setting, for example? Another approach is more physical, of course, and this is the FET TORI. So you start off with an initial condition that is in equilibrium and is a FET TORI solution that has been considered last year by John Hawley. Those calculations are polytropic, so the entropy is constant. Solutions also so far don't really show large-scale magnetic fields yet, which is perhaps because of a lack of a long, significantly long time span of the simulation. Maybe the fact that the entropy is constant does not allow you to really get a strong anchoring of the magnetic field in the disk plane, which you would require in order to do the magnetocentrifugal acceleration effect. Also, of course, there's another mechanism that can drive outflows, which you would have if you have an entropy gradient, namely pressure-driven winds. That's something we've been just looking at recently in connection with two-dimensional simulations. But that, too, would be a possible setting to do real turbulence calculations by prescribing the disk in terms of an entropy profile locally. So that would allow you to do really global simulations where the density would depend on height, and you would have the possibility of pressure-driven outflows. But it, of course, is in some sense unphysical because the entropy must really, of course, evolve with the flow, which it cannot. One more plot I wanted to show here is how the large-scale effect, large-scale magnetic field actually, what kind of distribution does it have? Normally, all functions in turbulence are seen to be exponentially distributed, like so. This is here. These are here probability density functions of the velocity, of the vorticity, and of the current. They all appear to be exponentially distributed. But the magnetic field actually also has, first of all, the magnetic field has a distribution which is, or a kurtosis, which is close to 3. So you would think it's therefore Gaussian, but it's very different from Gaussian because it has a very skew appearance. And so that's the way how you can have actually a large-scale magnetic field. So often people think of a scale separation, that you have a small-scale field and a large-scale field. So you think of really just the turbulence, some small-scale stuff, and then which of course has a distribution like this, and then you have somehow a large-scale field which has either sign, like here. But in fact, it really combines into a histogram which is like this, and that's the way how the large-scale fields actually manifested itself in such a simulation. And the kurtosis as a function of time typically shows a flip-flop behavior of this form here. I didn't mean to spend so much time here on this first view graph. What I originally had in mind was to do something like a follow. What? What I originally had in mind was to do what was to try a follow up on the calculations that Wung Tai and in Eve have been presenting. And of course, it's not possible because of the lack of time. I've just got started on that. So this is one possible way of how we could maybe in the next few days address this issue. This is just the initial behavior of the toroidal MRI using this kind of initial condition, and we do find the typical behavior as anticipated in Wung Tai's plot. In particular, you have you just begin to generate toroidal motions because of this Coriolis force. Once you have expanding regions, the Coriolis force leads to an anticyclonic behavior, which corresponds to rotation in this direction, which you see here. The solid contour corresponds to outgoing movement motion, ingoing motion. So this is just the linear stage in resistive stage. And I think by carrying on these calculations, maybe one can really make contact between the more idealized linear calculations and the fully developed turbulent calculations.